From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
In my entire time in the Senate, this may be the most complicated bill and the most challenging negotiation of which I've ever been part. Inaction has consequences, and this is urgent. And there are so many folks that I'm worried about. I'm worried about the nuclear power plant worker who's staring up at the ceiling right now, wondering if she's going to have a job or going to have to move her family out of state. I'm worried about the small business owner who's deciding whether or not to make even more investments in Illinois and whether all that money already sunk into the business is going to pay off. And I'm worried about young people like my 17-year-old who still wonder if the grown-ups are ever going to get serious about climate change.
Someone had a very, very deliberate way of drawing this such that, well, I'm going to keep it clean. I'm going to be nice. You didn't care about our voting rights. And this dilutes Black voting power to the hilt.
It's Valerie Leonard from Illinois African Americans for Equitable Redistricting. Before that, we heard from the Senate President Don Harmon. Democrats approving a new legislative district map this week, but not everyone happy with the results. And we're not just talking about Republicans. Also, the Senate moved ahead with energy legislation, passing it over to the House, but it is far from a done deal. We will discuss what lawmakers being back in session this past week accomplished, and when might they return to the State House. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, Emeritus Professor and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie has also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel is NPR Illinois State House Editor. And joining us this week, Mark Maxwell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. And Mark, it's always good to have you on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Mark, let me start with you. Redistricting, the latest vote was on some changes to the map that was approved back in the spring. So I guess I would want to know, is there much difference in what moved through this week compared to that earlier version?
Well, we got a very late glimpse of the maps themselves and the plain English that describes those changes in the districts right before lawmakers in the House and Senate, Democrats to be specific, would approve them. So there was little time to go over all of that before the vote. But independent redistricting experts who analyzed the data and, you know, compared it with the new census information said that the biggest change between map one in May and map two in August was not really addressing any of the different concerns from Jewish groups, Muslim American groups, or Latino groups, but rather it was political and partisan. It was really to max, they took the census data and used it to reshape the map lines to really stick it to the Republicans. That was the analysis from Frank Calabrese, who's been doing this for several different outfits in the Chicago area especially, but also statewide. And he really saw the biggest changes just further accentuating the partisan impact more than anything else. And the biggest evidence he had for that was that the census data showed us that the Hispanic and Latino voter bloc in Illinois grew by 300,000 plus voters in the last decade, and yet they lost a seat in Springfield, a majority Hispanic or a majority Latino seat, one or two seats between the House and Senate. So there wasn't any update that would have reflected the demographic shift. And that shows a clear hypocrisy or a contrast between the rhetoric from Democrats and their actions, because all along, the Democrats who chaired and led these committees said that we're going to uplift the diversity of our state, we're going to show the strength of our diversity. And their maps just didn't do that.
Most significant change, and one that obviously had to be made or the maps would have been thrown out as totally unconstitutional, was that they jiggled the lines to make the districts more equal in population. I think the initial map had some districts, when the actual census numbers came out, some districts were, far outside the 10% limit that's been set by the federal courts over the years.
They were 30% off, yeah.
Yeah, and Calabrese, I saw a quote from him saying the map that came out of committee. This is before they voted on it the other day. All the districts are basically the same at 108,000 population and change. And the maps that we've been operating under for the last 10 years, the population difference between the most populous and least populous county, or pardon me, district, was exactly one.
So what that really tells you is they were shoring up the map from lawsuit challenges,
yeah,
threats in court, but they were sort of leaving themselves open or vulnerable to what is truly a more subjective argument, but one that several different Latino groups and Black groups are already making, that their voices were not considered in this process. Courts are going to have to consider that challenge.
Yeah, a couple of things that I wonder about. The Census Bureau changed the way it counted people this time around, in terms of there were many more people who put down that they were multiracial than had happened in the past. And the Hispanic question, the Latino question, has nothing to do with race. It's more your cultural identity. And so how do you factor that in to figure out how many districts there are? And where did the growth occur? And the reason I ask is because there are some downstate areas that now have a pretty large Hispanic population, but do not have a majority and could not be made into a majority district. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in federal court.
Yeah, and speaking of court, of course, Hannah, the governor, it's going to be up to him, I guess, next on whether or not to sign this into law. But there are already legal challenges out there before, and more are probably coming, it seems.
That's right. So, you know, Republicans, I think, filed their lawsuit first in June, shortly after the governor signed the maps. And then MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, this prominent voting rights advocacy group in Chicago, filed theirs as expected. MALDEF, by the way, has had the most success in, you know, the decades of redistricting litigation. And, you know, Mark is right. The Democrats, it was a pretty basic ask. And, you know, we all knew that they had to do it after the spring. They even said on the floor they would adjust the maps based on the census information that came out late in mid-August. So, you know, they got the easy thing that was like a very obvious problem to fix out of the way. But, you know, they might, as Mark said, be leaving themselves vulnerable. I don't know how, you know, what they've done with this new revised version of the maps at all clears them of the allegations that they're being shortchanged, that their voting power is going to be diluted. But of course, that is a more subjective kind of question. And it hasn't always been successful. It's a mixed bag, but again, MALDEF has had the most success in the history of redistricting litigation in Illinois.
Yeah, Mark, Democrats held hearings, I know, across the state about these maps or about the redistricting process. Just how transparent has all of this been?
Well, that's an interesting question. Certainly there have been people testifying. Certainly there have been opportunities. The question, if you ask that question to Democrats, they're going to tell you, hey, we promoted these, we put word out. The second round, the question really is, how much public interest is there? I mean, just ask yourself, do you want to go on a Monday night when there's a big football game on or a big basketball game on? Would you rather be at home watching that or in a big open gymnasium listening to politicians bicker with each other about where to draw a line on a map for 10 years that you don't really understand, you know, how that line and its placement affects you? I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg argument. You know, what comes first, poor public notice or the fact that it's just a complex, difficult, complicated thing to really influence, right? Most people, when you ask them who should pick their vote, should politicians pick their voters or should voters pick their politicians? On that poll question, they say, oh, absolutely. It should be voters picking their politicians. We should take the pen out of their hand. But that's about where public interest stops, or at least it becomes more complex, right? So people don't have the time, really, to dig in and draw their own map. It just becomes very complicated.
Despite the fact that the hearings could be characterized as more for show than for actual input, in the redistricting that occurred in 71, 81, 91, 2001, there was, when the maps finally were drawn, there was zero public participation.
Yeah, and Hannah,
it's kind of the same question on, I mean, we've seen this in the pandemic too. I mean, who do you really want giving public health guidance? Average Joe on the street corner or the expert? Yeah. So that's kind of the same thing here.
But Hannah, I think it's also, and I think Mark touched on this, it's hard to get somebody enthused about trying to change a process when they feel as though this is a done deal. I mean, the Democratic Party, or if it was the Republicans in control, are going to do what they're going to do. And me as just the average Joe, I'm not going to be able to sway them on some of these issues. So it seems like, especially on a process like this, as political as this process is, the public probably doesn't feel it has much of a say.
Right. I mean, it's hard to say whether things would be different in another state or if we, you know, didn't have the history of that we do. But I think that general sentiment is correct, that people feel a little bit like, well, it's inherently the most political process that you could possibly have is drawing the maps. You know, but the court case is not over, and we're going to have a lot of action on it later, I think, this fall. And, you know, it's still a possibility, although it is a long shot, that the courts will just take over the redistricting process if it finds that the arguments from especially Latino groups hold water and that their voices are, in fact, being diluted. The Republicans, of course, they want to get to that bipartisan appointed commission that's taken place in the past. If you go past that June 30th deadline, of course, Democrats, they hold all the power. Why would you risk giving Republicans a 50-50% chance to control the process if it goes to a tiebreak situation, which it usually does? But, you know, so they still want that. That legal argument seems a pretty big long shot. But the chance that the federal court will have to oversee it, that might not be such a long shot anymore.
If the courts don't step in and intervene here, some analysts have said that, for example, House Democrats right now hold 73 seats and a supermajority in Illinois. Analysts who've looked at these maps have said they could gain up to 80, up to even 85 seats, further cementing their complete, you know, control on the Illinois legislature. What does that look like? You're going to see the same thing. Republicans doing this in places like Texas, North Carolina. So you're going to see a furthering of probably gridlock in Congress, where control there is kind of stalled, and state houses across the country really advancing the polarized partisan agendas. You're going to see red states do things that are more prone to get applause from the far right. You're going to see blue states like Illinois do things that are more progressive, more liberal. And that's going to continue going even farther than we've seen it this last decade.
Yeah, and Shirley, I've always heard that, you know, that the process, nobody's happy with this process of the way things are done. They've also always said that among lawmakers that, you know, of all the legislation that they deal with, this one probably has the most interest because it affects every one of them in their political future. Yet, again, they all stand up, say there needs to be a better way, and we never get it. And my guess is 10 years from now, we're going to be talking about the same thing.
Yeah, that's probably true. I may not be here to comment on it, but I don't see much change. The one possibility would be for a citizens' initiative. Now, we had one a couple of years ago where petitions were passed and they had sufficient numbers to put the proposed amendment before the voters, but it was challenged in court by Democratic powers and the court threw it out. And the reason was because the proposed constitutional amendment went beyond the very narrow bounds of what's allowed in the Illinois Constitution for citizens' initiatives. And at the time, I thought to myself, this would have been very easy to avoid had the people who drafted the petition and the amendment either been more aware or more interested in getting it done. In very simple terms, the Constitution says the only thing that citizens can change in the Constitution deals with the legislative article. And the proposal also involved, that went before the court, also involved the finance article. And so the court said, well, no, you're involving two articles. The Constitution says only one. So if you could draft an amendment, a proposed amendment that would only cover the legislative article and not bring in other articles, I think you could get the support for it, and the court would probably allow it, and it could go before voters, and then they would have their chance to put in some kind of an independent operation. And this talk about this bipartisan independent, I mean, that's baloney. No offense to the good government groups that are pushing it. If it goes to the commission, it's not going to be a bipartisan and we're all going to do kumbaya on that. It'll be, as has been said earlier, and as Hannah pointed out, it'll go down to the luck of the draw, and that's what Republicans are gambling for. They want to win that draw so that they can gerrymander instead of the Democrats. It's as simple as that.
Well, alternatively, in 2028, the question will go before voters, as it does every 20 years, if we want to have another constitutional convention to rewrite our 1970 Constitution. And, you know, maybe this time it'll happen.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and WCIA-TV's Mark Maxwell. Mark, there was an energy package. It's been on the table for months, negotiations taking place. It would really chart Illinois' energy future for decades to come, but there are also some current situations that need to be addressed, including nuclear plant jobs, a couple of nuclear plants that are slated to close. So a lot of moving parts in this. The Senate approved a version this week, but it's not done, as we'd mentioned earlier. Where does this all stand?
Right. Well, when you go back to Governor Pritzker's inaugural address, he said that Illinois wants to sign on to the Paris Climate Accord, and that the goal here is to have a carbon-free energy sector in Illinois by 2050. So still a ways out. But now the big question is, if we're going to start cutting and curbing carbon emissions from coal and natural gas power plants in Illinois over the next 24 years to 2045, how quickly can we really do that in a way that doesn't destabilize our electric grid? And that really sums up the last lingering bit of disagreement between many Democrats and the governor's office. They're trying to get enough votes together to make that happen. In the middle of all that, you have this sort of bridge between coal and natural gas to wind and solar, which is nuclear power. I think nuclear power plants in Illinois create about 60% of our clean energy. And ComEd, Exelon, ComEd's parent company, is standing in the middle of this negotiation saying to the state, if you don't give us nearly $700 million in taxpayer funds over the next 5 years to help, then we're going to have to close our nuclear power plants and essentially blow up that bridge between coal and natural gas to that cleaner energy future. So that's the controversial part of all this. For those that follow Illinois politics, they're familiar with the ComEd corruption case in that deal from 2016 that looked very similar to this one, where ComEd raised its electric rates on its consumers across the state, in the northern part of the state, and its parent company got a whole lot of extra money from the state itself. So it's a win-win for Exelon, but they know they have leverage here. So that's the question is, can the House agree on this plan that passed the Senate? And that's where things stand right now.
The big ironies in this is the fact that the ComEd portion, the Exelon portion, and the nuke plants, that was pretty much agreed to by everybody. And the hangup now is over a couple of coal-fired generating stations, one here in Springfield, City Water, Light, and Power, and the other down in the Metro East area.
Yeah, Hannah, and just how close are they? I mean, like Charlie said, a lot of this seems to have been, there seemed to be some agreement, at least on several of these parts. So, I mean, are they just a few days away from getting a deal? Or?
I mean, that depends on how soon folks are going to get together. And by folks, I mean, this at this level, it needs to be worked out between the governor, the House Speaker, and the Senate President. And really, since Chris Welch has kind of taken a backseat to this and is deferring to the governor, then really between the governor and Don Harmon. So And then also we have to get folks back to Springfield. The Senate punted, and you know, that's probably a good thing to put it in a new arena where things, you know, things have definitely calcified over the summer. There's really not much movement, you know, because the governor and environmental groups, they still want both hard closure dates and a decarbonization schedule, meaning that these coal and natural gas fired power plants would have to step down their emissions, you know, year over year on a, you know, a schedule until 2045. And so their argument is, or the arguments from the, you know, plants and organized labor, whose, you know, members staff the plants, is that, you know, you can't expect, it's not an economical argument to ask these plants to both put in the investments for this very expensive technology, which, by the way, it has not, you know, we're hopefully it'll advance in the coming decades to get down to zero emissions. But, you know, that's also a big gamble. That's a fingers crossed kind of proposition. And so they're saying, why would we invest billions of dollars only to have our plants then close at the end of the timeline? And so I don't know. It's going to be a really tight squeeze, but we have, I mean, Exelon is not kidding about closing down their nuclear plant up in Byron. It is not a joke. And, you know, then the argument from labor and the Senate Democrats is that, well, you know, it's, what do we gain by forcing the shutdown? We would then have to import more dirty energy, thus undermining our ultimate climate goals.
Yeah, one of those plants, the Dresden plant near Morris in northern Illinois, yeah, surely that is, if not the oldest operating plant in the country, it is right up there. I mean, I've heard for a long time that, you know, ComEd's looking to decommission that plant and, you know, maybe a couple of others. That this has come up so many times in the past. I mean, what's to say that anything that's done right now is going to stop another attempt to try to subsidize those plants in the future?
Well, I think the way the legislation is drafted, the understanding, at least with Exelon, would be that the plant in Byron and the plant in Dresden and the plant in Braidwood, which is also up in the Joliet area, would be operating into the future for at least five more years. And you're right about Dresden. As I think we discussed the other day, when I was in high school, eons ago, when the dinosaurs roamed the earth, one of my good friends in high school, his dad was an engineer who was, and they weren't from Joliet where I grew up, but he was in Joliet because he was working on helping build the Dresden plant. So that gives you an idea how old it is.
Yeah, just a couple of minutes left here. Mark, I want to move on to COVID-19. We touch on that just about every week. A lot of schools now back in session, most of them in the state. And already we're running into a lot of problems with some outbreaks that are occurring, cancellations of extracurriculars like sports. You know, what's the governor had to say about this?
Well, there have been, as seems to be the case, or the trend over the last year and a half, a lot of people close to the education arena spreading rumors that, you know, you see these dozens of schools going remote because of outbreaks or things happening here or there. All of a sudden, it starts to raise that question of, oh my goodness, could we see this happen statewide? Is the governor planning to send students back home again? The governor's office is saying no, those rumors are not true. In fact, next Tuesday, there's a testing that right after Labor Day, there's supposed to be a deadline where teachers have to start getting their vaccine or they have to start submitting to testing. Some of the different education and teachers unions have balked at that a little bit. They said they want to make vaccines optional. Some of that testing, they're still negotiating over how to implement that, even as the deadline is already fast approaching. But you're right. You are seeing a number. I think there's just down to a few dozen out of the nearly 900 public school districts in the state are still saying they won't enforce a mask mandate indoors, and they could risk being decertified and even defunded if they continue down that line. But this is really a big, messy attempt at getting every school in the state back with students in person trying to return to normal, even as the coronavirus is still trying to eat its way through unvaccinated populations.
Yeah, and Hannah, just about 30 seconds left. The governor's been pretty noncommittal when it comes to what the next steps might be. And I don't know if you could read any more into it than I could.
No, I mean, when he implemented his statewide mask mandate last Thursday, you know, I asked him why not also issue some metrics that people can kind of follow and be hopeful about, you know, when we reach these metrics, we'll be safe again. And he has yet to say what they will be. But, you know, earlier this week, he said, you know, he's looking especially at the number of new people that are getting admitted to the hospital each day. But yeah, it's kind of a black box as of now.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. And Mark, let's start with you.
Sure. Speaking about coronavirus, the pandemic politics is always interesting. For a few weeks now, Representative Tony McCombie from the western part of the state, she's a Republican in House leadership, who has been peppering Governor Pritzker's office with Freedom of Information Act emails saying, show me the data, show me the science, show me the people advocating in support of this mask mandate. She was hoping to trip the governor up and try to embarrass him, saying, you don't actually have proof that this is required. Well, the governor's office has been kind of fed up with this narrative. So they printed out 870 pages from a span of just 5 weeks, from hundreds of letters from parents, and all of these pages of studies from the CDC and other places supporting the mask mandate. In fact, many of the parents' pleas spelled out why they felt a vocal minority of critics at school boards were pressuring schools to lift the mask mandate, and they were begging the governor, please implement this, one even organizing a protest. And the governor's office printed all those pages out and hand-delivered it to Representative McCombie's office while she was in Springfield to try and make the point that there's more people in support of this than you might think.
Okay, Hannah?
Well, listeners might remember that in June, there was an outbreak of COVID at a church camp in Rushville in Western Illinois. And as the numbers grew, as data, you know, started rolling in, it was pretty obvious. It was, you know, an outbreak that was, one, fueled by the unvaccinated and also the Delta variant, which at that point was not as much of a threat as it is now. But the CDC kind of did one of their case studies on it, and it turns out that it led to 180 confirmed and probable cases of COVID among the folks who went to the church camp and then a related conference that was held a little bit later.
Okay. And Charlie?
Well, we got our numbers for August, and Professor J. Fred Geertz at U of I, who compiles the monthly U of I Flash Index, reports that the index fell slightly, a tad, in August to 105.6 from 105.8 in July. But he points out this should not be a cause of concern, since the economy has reached its pre-crisis and is still growing at a healthy rate, because everything above 100 is growth. So things are kind of moving in the right direction, slowly but surely.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week, and our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell with WCIA-TV. And don't forget, you can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org through the NPR One app or iTunes. And don't forget to join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.